Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. We're hearing from two great public intellectuals who set up shop in the land of the bean and the cod, that is, Boston. Last week we heard from the late Howard Zinn. This week, Noam Chomsky. Chomsky taught linguistics for many years at MIT. His contributions to the theory and academic study of linguistics, specifically grammar, were not only profound but revolutionary. I studied Chomsky's system of grammar back in graduate school many moons ago. It's complex, it's elegant, and it does a much better job of explaining how language really works than the 19th century schoolbook grammar we teach children. Chomsky also has a tremendous knowledge of political affairs and has published many books and articles on U.S. foreign and domestic policy. I've read his book, Manufacturing Consent. It's a fine analysis of the fog of propaganda spread out by the elite news media and masquerading as serious reporting. Propaganda serving to justify our imperial adventures. Chomsky is good at demonstrating the hypocrisy of our government. Over and over he reveals the gap between piously professed principles and actual actions. He's particularly good on our government's long-standing hypocrisy on Israel and Palestine. Surprisingly, Chomsky has little useful to say about 9/11. You would think he would be the first to point out the utter preposterousness of the government's official story of exactly what happened that day. I'll just mention a couple of tidbits from the official story. A skyscraper not hit by an airplane suddenly collapsing in 6.5 seconds onto its own footprint. Yet somehow not a controlled demolition, no sir. A large airplane hitting the ground in Pennsylvania and evaporating. The entire U.S. air defense unable even to get close to any of 4 commercial airliners off course and flying hours apart. Nobody in the entire defense establishment charged, fired, demoted, or even scolded for the disaster. Contrast Bradley Manning. Almost all of the alleged hijackers, Saudi Arabians, allegedly led by a Saudi Arabian mastermind, all allegedly funded with Saudi Arabian money. So in retaliation, our military attacks? Afghanistan, and then Iraq. Did I mention that our government did not file any criminal charges against Osama bin Laden related to 9/11? You'd think that any thinking person would say, I don't know exactly what happened on 9/11, but there's a certain barnyard odor clinging to the official story. You'd think it, but you'd be wrong. Noam Chomsky failed us here. He said, basically, we citizens have no independent knowledge of what happened on 9/11, so we might as well trust the government's official story. It's hard to think of a statement that sounds less like Chomsky. But there you have it. On balance, though, on other subjects, Chomsky has done much good. He's shown the gap between whom the government pretends to serve, us the people, and whom the government really serves, which is 0.1%. Chomsky's public lectures are too complex for radio excerpts. He's more accessible in interviews, and we hear some parts of some now. They're about American politics and the American economy. We'll start with the Cold War and how the Soviet government and the U.S. government each falsely claimed that the Soviets were practicing socialism. With both sides lying like that, poor socialism never had a chance. Next, Chomsky discusses how the U.S. system keeps power away from the people. And he praises the people for Occupy Wall Street and kindred movements. Here's Noam Chomsky.
The Leninist system was one of the greatest blows that socialism suffered in the 20th century. maybe second only to fascism. I mean, as Lenin took power, among its first acts, along with Trotsky, were to destroy the socialist institutions that had arisen in the pre-Bolshevik period. Soviets, factory councils, constituent assembly, which was dominated by left social revolutionaries, largely peasant-based. And of course, they went to war against the anarchists, a major war to try to wipe them out, the Makhno's army and so on. And there was a sort of a logic behind it. They were orthodox Marxists. Unlike Marx, incidentally, they believed in a version of Marxism that said that revolution can't come in a backward peasant society, which is what Russia was. It was what we would now call a third world country, an undeveloped peasant society with some development, but owned by the West and so on. I mean, a highly educated and productive intellectual class, but that's also true of third world societies. So they thought this couldn't happen. So therefore we have to drive this backward population through industrialization by force. And then later on, by the iron laws of history and so on and so forth, will come the socialism. Of course, it's all nonsense. But so they essentially laid the basis for a totalitarian system with an ideological doctrine behind it. When the Soviet Union collapsed, I actually wrote an article saying this is a victory for socialism, small victory for socialism. I just couldn't get it published. Nobody knew what I was talking about. The world's two major propaganda systems, the West and the Soviet Union, they both determined to use the word socialism to refer to the totalitarian system of the Soviet Union. I mean, the West did it to discredit socialism. The Bolsheviks did it to try to gain, you know, the credit associated with genuine socialism. Well, when the world's two propaganda systems agree, it's going to be very hard for people to extricate themselves from it. So now socialism, has been degraded to mean the form of totalitarianism instituted by Lenin, carried through by Stalin. And I was going back to Spain. It was entirely natural that they should be in the lead in destroying the popular revolution. Bakunin, much earlier, had predicted all of this. He said that in the future, it'll be two forms. One form will be they'll take over the state and they'll create a red bureaucracy, which will be the most vile and brutal regime the world's ever seen. And there are others who will understand that they can't take over the state, so they have to serve concentrated private power and state power. And they'll be the technical intelligentsia who, you know, implement the policies of the masters in what we now call liberal democracies, which is a very good prediction. It's one of the few predictions in the social sciences that actually came true, which is one of the reasons why nobody ever studies it. It's much too dangerous and too insightful. If a decision is made by a centralized authority, it's going to represent the interests of a particular group in power. If power is actually rooted in large parts of the population, if people can actually participate in social planning, then they will presumably do so in terms of their own interests. Now, that's why Madison, for example, and Lippmann, and Bernays, and a whole host of others have argued that we cannot permit the population to participate, because if they do, they will pursue their own interests, not the interests of the wealth of the nation. If you have centralized power, they'll use it for their own interests. You don't have to read that in a complicated textbook. It should be, it's understandable by any 10-year-old child, not by educated people, though they have it driven out of their heads, have various illusions replacing self-serving illusions. Public opinion is very well studied, so we have a wealth of information about what the public wants, and there's a huge disconnect between public opinion and public policy. The public and policymakers differ enormously on crucial issues. It's all very natural. It's nothing surprising about it, and people understand it. So about 80% of the population in the United States says that the government is run by a few big interests looking out for themselves.
Here's Chomsky on Occupy Wall Street.
Thought crime.
Well, briefly, I think they're a pretty fantastic development, actually inspiring development. I mean, if you think about the comments I made at the very end, you know, we've been living in a kind of an unprecedented period. After hundreds of years of growth and development, the advanced industrial societies, the United States, Britain, and the lead, have entered into a period of stagnation, decline. It's not the same as American decline of power over the world. That's been going on for a long time. But internal decline for a majority of the population. And also kind of loss of hope, much less sense of hopefulness than there was. That's quite, doesn't have to happen. These are particular policy choices. Different ones can easily be adopted and thought of. Finally, there's a reaction to it. The Occupy movements are the first major kind of sort of spontaneous in a way, but now they've expanded and have many features in common. This is the first organized mass popular reaction to a major assault against the populations. And that's got to be important. Now, the very fact that it's taken place has already left, a legacy of change that's going to remain, whatever their outcome is. Now, it's not going to be easy to go on. It's necessary to recognize that victories are not won quickly.
On New World Notes, we're listening to Noam Chomsky on American politics and the American economy. In the next segment, he goes into more detail about the gap between what the public wants and what the government gives them instead. He talks about how political power is now sold to the highest bidder. And he tells of how the American economic collapse was made possible by political acts. Acts made by a government that serves Wall Street profits rather than its citizens. From an interview in November with Alex Heil, here is Noam Chomsky.
Politics does not mean loyalty to a party, unless you're in the Communist Party or something, or some, you know, some sect. It means making choices and evaluating. There have been times when I've voted for Republicans. There have been times where I voted for Democrats. Depends who they are, what the circumstances are. At times when I voted against all of them, you know, maybe Green or something like that. Well, I think we're in a very dangerous situation today in a lot of respects. One of them, in fact, has to do with democracy. You know, democracy has many dimensions. It's not yes or no. But one fairly reasonable measure of democracy is how close public policy is to the public will. You don't expect to be perfect. I mean, our elected representatives are not supposed to look at polls and just do what the polls say. But in a functioning democracy, public opinion and public policy ought to be fairly closely aligned. If not, there's something wrong with the system. If you take a look at the United States today, the gap between public opinion and public policy is a chasm. So take, for example, what's been the most important central issue in Washington in the past months, the deficit. What does the public think the major issue is? Well, we know very well, there are extensive polls. Overwhelmingly, the public thinks the major issue is jobs and deficit. The deficit's a minor issue. And they, incidentally, happen to be correct in my judgment. The deficit may turn out to be a problem in the long term, but right now it's not a major problem. You can tell that by just looking at interest on bonds. People or investors are very happy to buy U.S. Treasury bonds at very low rates because they don't think there's a problem. Jobs, on the other hand, is a huge problem. For the banks, the deficit's a problem. They don't like deficits. It might ultimately, not in the near future, but ultimately lead to inflation, which is not a serious prospect today, but they don't like it. So on the one hand, you have the banks. On the other hand, you have the population. Take a look at policy. It's the deficit. It's a deficit commission, no jobs commission. Well, just keep to the deficit, a minor problem from the point of view of the public. How do you deal with the deficit? Well, the public has opinions about that, pretty strong opinions and pretty consistent ones. By a very large margin, the public believes that we should preserve the benefits that we have, like Medicare and Social Security, and that we should reverse the policy of sharply reducing taxes for the very wealthy. We should go back to what taxes were during the period of substantial economic growth in the 50s and 60s, the 90s again. So we should increase taxes on the tiny percentage of the population, actually a fraction of 1%, that has gained enormously from the policies of the past generation, while for the majority there's been virtual stagnation. Those are the public attitudes. The policy is going to be the opposite. No taxation on the very wealthy and cutting away at benefits. Those are exactly the policies that are being proposed. Now, there's a kind of a invented terminology in this case. They've invented a new term for the super rich. You're not supposed to call them the super rich. You're supposed to call them the job creators. These people, we have good evidence. These are people who are sitting on the greatest profits in the history of corporate America. It's breaking records at the same time that the pay for working people is declining to its lowest level. So what we're supposed to do, according to the Republican Party, it's almost unanimous, is to stuff the pockets of those whose pockets are already bulging with dollars that they don't know what to do with, and harm those who are suffering. Well, you know, this is so far, and the Democrats are not saying, yes, let's do that, but they're not that far behind. So, for example, some of the leaks from the Deficit Commission committee meetings indicated that the Democrats were proposing partial privatization of Medicare. Well, that's if you partially privatize Medicare, that will, in fact, reduce the federal deficit, but by transferring the costs to the elderly, it takes the costs away from the tax system, which has at least some participation by the very rich, and you hand it over to the elderly who don't have the money for it. It's just class war of the kind that's been going on for 30 years.
And the class war that's being presented to us isn't necessarily coming from the people, correct? Both right and left believe that the job creators are the people that are the small businessmen, not the super rich that are taking our jobs out of our country because globalization has made it cheaper and more profitable to do business elsewhere.
That's one of the factors, and we should also remember that the federal government is a major job creator. In fact, it's also a major source of innovation, dynamism, creation of new technology, and so on. I mean, everybody uses the computer and the Internet these days, but not many people are aware of the fact that mostly that came out of federal government spending in the 50s, and primarily in the 1950s and the 1960s. Decades later, it was handed over to private entrepreneurs to turn into commodities. And that's the same right across the board, pharmaceuticals, IT revolution, and much else. But yes, small businesses and the federal government are the major job creators. Multinational corporations, you know, the really big ones, are creating jobs, but overseas, as you say.
Yeah.
For them, it's more profitable to exploit super cheap labor in Foxconn in China than to pay decent wages here. And that also should be reversed. If we don't have a manufacturing system in the United States, the country's really going to decline.
What got us here?
There are two major developments that have taken place in roughly the past 30 years, and they're related. One of them is what you mentioned, the offshoring of production and manufacturing for reasons of profit, not private profit harms the country. The second, which is associated with it, is the shift of the economy from production of things that are needed to financial manipulations. The financial institutions, which used to operate the way banks are supposed to work in a capitalist society. They say in the 50s and the 60s, the major growth period in American history, in fact, world history. During that period, a bank was a bank. It took unused capital, like, say, your bank account, and transferred it to some constructive use, like starting a business or sending your kid to college or buying a house or something. Since the late 70s and increasingly over the years, these financial institutions have been essentially playing games with money, speculating against currencies, trying to cut off a second from trading times, things like that. That does almost nothing for the economy, probably harms it. And it takes a huge amount of the available capital. By 2007, just before the latest crash, financial institutions were actually making about 40% of corporate profit, which is grotesque. That's part of the means by which a tiny fraction of the population has enriched itself beyond the dreams of avarice, while for the general population there has been something like stagnation. Now, that has other effects. It's poisoned the political system. The cost of elections has gone way up, and that means that they're, to a larger and larger extent, bought by concentrated wealth, corporate wealth, that's the source of concentration of capital. Even, at congressional level, I mean, it used to be that if somebody would move ahead to a position of some prestige and influence in Congress, it was a result of seniority or service or something like that. Now, increasingly, chairmanships are bought. The money has to go into the party coffers. That, again, drives political leaders into the pockets of the very wealthy. And all of this forms a kind of a vicious cycle, which is getting worse and worse. The recent distribution of income that I mentioned is the worst it's ever been. And the decline of the functioning of the democratic system is similar. It's in parallel. These are real problems.
I think that Democrats and Republicans can agree that legislators are being bought by lobbyists and that the amount of money just to be elected is so huge that one has to become corrupt in order to just enter the system.
You know, that's always been true to some extent, but it's become greatly exaggerated in the past generation. Another thing that's happened in the past generation is financial crises, starting with the Reagan years. There have been repeated financial crises. Before that, in the Eisenhower and Kennedy Johnson years, 50s and 60s, there were no financial crises. The New Deal regulations were in place, and the banks were functioning, as I said, more or less like banks, not like speculators. The first big financial crisis was in the early 80s, another one later in the Reagan years. Reagan left office, leaving the worst financial crisis since the Depression, the savings and loan crisis. There was another one at the end of the Clinton years, the tech bubble burst, and the monster of all crises that we're right in the middle of, that's the Bush crisis, second Bush, the bursting of the housing bubble, $8 trillion of paper wealth lost. Countries take a long time to emerge from that. These are the direct results of legislative decisions like deregulation, which have the almost inevitable consequence of leading to these results. Well, you know, that is to the benefit of a top tiny fraction of the population, but not of the rest of us.
Where there's market unrest, prices go up. Who benefits from that?
Well, speculators benefit. And, of course, resource producers. They do benefit when gas prices, oil prices go up. But a lot of it, in food as well, is driven by speculative markets. And now we're back to the same financial institutions and speculators. None of this has to happen. These are not economic necessities. These are political choices. Same is true of bailouts. I mean, again, since the Reagan years, when deregulation really went into force and these other developments escalated, there has been a government insurance policy for big banks, what's called too big to fail. they know that they can make risky transactions, make a lot of money from them, and since they're risky, they're sooner or later going to crash, and when they do, the taxpayer will come in and bail them out. That's been going on since the early 80s. It was very dangerous. There's a word for it in the economics literature. It's called moral hazard, but it's built into the way we're current political economic system is functioning. As you move manufacturing, meaning production of useful goods, as you move that abroad and you shift the economic behavior into speculation, multiple financial transactions, a couple of seconds of trading up and back, as you do that, it means that for the general economy and society, things are getting worse. Even though a small sector, typically hedge fund managers, CEOs, others, a very tiny sector, it's actually a tenth of a percent of the population, have just become spectacularly wealthy.
With the ease of transfer of wealth, meanwhile, the general public who need jobs are out.
Yeah, there's been for roughly 30 years, a little more, a fairly general stagnation. People have been getting by in the United States, but by measures that aren't sustainable. One of them is debt. Well, obviously, that's not sustainable. Another is asset inflation, like bubbles, which, of course, burst. Another is just by working more. Americans now work longer hours than, I think, probably any industrial society, far more than Europe. And that's a cost, too. It means you don't have leisure. And that means that you have to have the two members of the family working, and without real support systems like government daycare, it is very hard to have child care and so on. Another problem in the United States, and it's a very serious one, is the health care system. Our health care is actually an international scandal. It's more than twice the per capita cost of other industrial countries, Europe, Japan, and so on. And it doesn't have good outcomes. Has some of the worst outcomes. And the reason is it's largely privatized and unregulated. The other systems are either government systems or closely regulated. In fact, if anyone really cares about the deficit, we could wipe out the deficit completely by just having the same kind of healthcare system that other industrial countries do. Now, that's not a utopian dream.
And no utopian dreamer is Noam Chomsky. We've been hearing some of his very logical, factual observations about how American politics and the American economy actually work. I've gently edited all of the audio we heard. The remarks we just heard came from Alex Heil's podcast, Federal Legislative. Before that, we borrowed from the film Human Resources and an audio collage by Virtual Renderings titled Thought Crimes. Thanks to the producers, and you'll find links to the pieces at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll also find an archive of this and past installments and other goodies. And thanks to you for listening. Please come back next week. Illegitimi non carborundum, and ciao.